This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome everyone to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Jack Draper and Alex DeMenor are your first grass court winners of 2024. We have DeMenor over Korda in Hertogenbosch. We have Draper over Berrettini for his first career ATP title in Stuttgart. And we're going to get into both of those finals. End of the video. A couple of notes on Queens and Halle. The week coming up is one of, I think, the best weeks of the season. And I'll talk a little bit about that. All right, back to the regularly scheduled programming. It feels almost weird after a major coming back so quickly and just going to kind of a normal week. But this is the one time where you don't have that week after a major lull. And it does feel like it picks up right away. Because clock is ticking, Wimbledon only 3 weeks away as of the end of Roland Garros. Now it's only 2 weeks away, so it is go time. And for Jack Draper, it is it's a massive week for so many reasons. Maybe he felt disappointed by the season he was having. I know that there was a lot of sentiment around the tennis world, evidenced, you know, even in mailbag questions where people were asking me, what's going on with Draper? Why is Draper disappointed this year? Why hasn't he lived up to expectations? And I was saying this even before last week, but especially after last week and with his first title in hand, it's almost like, are we sure it's a disappointing year? Because I'll be the first to admit that it hasn't been the season that I predicted it was going to be, and I don't think it will be. I thought that he would be on the cusp of the top 10 at the end of 2024. I no longer think that, and he hasn't been on track to do that. But let's not penalize the guy for our own outsized expectations. Because outside of any of the lofty predictions that certainly I and some other people had made about Draper's potential, if healthy, in 2024. Overall, it's been really positive. He started the year 62 in the world. Now he's 31. Good little leap in the rankings so far. He's still got half the year to work with. And from a health standpoint, this has been everything that we could have hoped it to be. 2021, he played 5 tour-level matches. 2022, he played 33 tour-level matches. 2023, he played 31 tour matches. This year, he's at 30. He's about to hit his career high in ATP main draw matches, and it's only June. Now, I get the other side of it, right? Clay was pretty ugly. I just think it was weird that folks were drawing certain conclusions from that, because he's a guy who grew up in the UK. There are no clay courts in the UK, but he seemed to avoid futures and challengers on clay as well. So it's just a gross lack of experience on the surface. Career record in clay challengers, 2-4. That's challengers. He's actually been better on the pro tour, but he hasn't been great. You have lack of experience, and it doesn't suit his strengths and weaknesses as a player. His main weakness being forehand firepower, the ability to do damage off of that wing. I think lacking a little bit of penetration off of his forehand from the back of the court. And there's nothing worse than that on clay, other than maybe being a poor mover. I mean, your forehand needs to do the talking on clay offensively. And for Draper, that's difficult. Plus, I don't think he's comfortable moving on it. Now, on grass, you kind of get away with the forehand stuff a little bit more. Why? Because there are other weapons for Jack that work really well on the surface. His serve was a major weapon throughout the week in Stuttgart. Above 85% first serve points won in every single match other than the one against Marcos Giron where he was above 80%. Ace rate, above 25%, over 25% ace rate, which is major serve bot territory, against Tiafo, where he hit a career high in aces, and Brandon Nakashima. So that's your quarterfinal, that's your semifinal. Both guys who are on the easier side when it comes to acing, but he certainly needed it against Francis, wins that in a third set tiebreak. Lefty slice serve is excellent. You know, that's a really good slider. Great speed. He's precise with it. It stays low. It has a lot of left to right action on the ball. And then off the ground, he's able to use his flat, precise backhand as a weapon. His backhand is better than his forehand, relatively speaking. And that's a quality that really suits the grass courts. And you can see it with a lot of examples. Because one, the court is quick enough that even if your backhand is not as big or as heavy as the, you know, super high-powered forehands on the tour, and basically nobody's backhand is that big, the court will do enough, will give you enough help. You'll get enough skid, you'll get enough speed through the conditions where your backhand can be used as a weapon. Not to mention, everybody just has to hit more backhands on grass because there's not enough time to run around. So if you have a great backhand, it does give you a little bit of a boost. So I can go from kind of lower level examples to higher level examples here. Guys who use the flat, precise backhand as a weapon, who are notably better on grass than they are on the other surfaces. And by the way, all of these guys are notably worse on clay as well. Dennis Kudla, Adrian Mannarino, Hugo Humbert, Andy Murray. These are all guys that don't have big, heavy, high RPM forehands, but they do have surgically precise, laser-like backhands that can be great weapons on grass. Draper's backhand caught fire in the third set of this Berrettini match. It caught absolute fire. It carried him through. He held for 3-all in the third set with a backhand down the line licker, an absolute beauty, probably the best of the bunch. And now it's 3-4. Berrettini double faults to put Jack on the board in this game, but Matteo is up 30-15. He misses a few first serves. They get into three rallies in a row, and all three rallies are terminated, are finished by the Draper backhand. Two winners and a forced error, and that's the break of serve for Jack. The match, though, ultimately, against Berrettini, it kind of hinged on Berrettini's backhand return. If you look at the big points, and, you know, these are two guys who weren't getting really broken much at all throughout the week and serving big. Matteo had been broken once. I think Draper had been broken three times. You're kind of expecting one of those grass court, tight, close margin matches. And that's exactly what it was. So you can look at a couple of big spots that kind of decided things. You know, first set, Berrettini won it on a loose Draper service game. Jack double faulted twice in the entire match, and it was 2-1 game. He also, in that game, he didn't make Berrettini win a single first serve return point. So Berrettini won all 4 points on the second serve, 2 he didn't need to play at all. It's just a bad game from Jack and kind of a malfunction of his serve momentarily. And it gave Berrettini the first set as Matteo was really dominant with his serve plus one. Now there's a chance for Matteo at 5-all in the second set. He's got a love 15 second serve and he misses a backhand return. He's got a 15-40 second serve. He misses another backhand return. Chances are, he breaks serve if he puts two decent returns in play on very standard Draper second serves into his backhand. But for as much as the Berrettini backhand is discussed, I think that by far the biggest problem with Mateo's backhand, or the biggest way that it hurts him, is on the second return, which he just can't be offensive on. For his play style, that is a big issue, because if he can't be offensive, his movement ends up getting exposed. And there are so many other players like Matteo Berrettini who also aren't the best movers, who also want to play attacking tennis and have big first serves and big forehands. But if you look at a guy like Jan-Lennard Struff or a guy like Nicolas Jarry, and I'm well aware that Matteo Berrettini is more accomplished than these guys, but one thing that they're able to do with similar play styles as Berrettini is they're able to be attacking on second returns. For Berrettini, if you just get the second serve to his backhand, he can't actually hurt you. You're going to get in a rally. And for a player with Berrettini's makeup, I feel like that's a pretty big issue at times. Plus, he misses some returns on his backhand like so. And, you know, I've always been a proponent of him running around more often. I don't really think that's an option against Draper's lefty movement and his you know, the fact that he gets such good width to the righty backhand with his leftiness. I don't think that's an option. I'm also kind of a proponent of Berrettini chipping, aggressively slicing second serve returns sometimes. He usually doesn't do these things. He usually goes for the drive second serve return. It often doesn't end up being that good. And on the other side of the coin, if we're talking about aggressive returning off of the second serve, Draper got the decisive mini break in the second set tiebreak by destroying a second serve return for a winner at 5-all in the second set tiebreak. It was a forehand inside out, but the thing is with Draper, right? Like when Jack decides that he wants to be aggressive on a second return, there's nowhere to hit the ball to Jack where you know you're completely safe, particularly on a grass court. Because he can obviously, he can rip his forehand and you're not safe going to his backhand either. In fact, you might be in more trouble going to his backhand. And that's, in my opinion, the difference. Because for Berrettini, you go to the backhand, you're safe. Another thing on the Berrettini backhand return, it wasn't just the second serve return misses, which to me were, that was his opportunity to win the match and win the final and win the title, right? But where Draper kind of took the match and took the final, yes, with his backhand catching fire in the third set, but also, if you look at the two biggest points of the match on Jack's serve, they were both on the ad side, and he hit a slice serve out wide to Berrettini's backhand and came in behind it, serve and volley. 6-5 in the second set tiebreak to close it out, hit a lovely backhand drop volley behind it, and at 2-3 in the third set, first break point in the deciding set went the way of Berrettini, and Draper slice out wide, serve and volley, and put away another volley winner on the first ball. Did not give Berrettini even a look at a pass. So I had Draper 4-for-4 on this play. I may have missed one because I was taking notes, but I wasn't charting every single point. But I had Draper 4-for-4 on serve and volley on the ad side, hitting that slider wide. And for Mateo, it puts him in a tough position. He can't really block the return on his backhand because that floats up. It's hard to keep that low. So he needs to try to drive it and get it low, but Berrettini doesn't really get a lot of natural bite on the ball off of his two-handed backhand. Doesn't get a violent dip. And I just think he doesn't have that loose left wrist that allows him to kind of whip through you know, on the racket drop. He doesn't get that heavy RPM on his backhand. And he also doesn't have great feel. So you don't need necessarily heavy topspin to get the ball low. If you're like Daniil Medvedev and you just have incredible feel on your backhand, you can actually hit the ball flat and keep it low. Mateo doesn't really have that either. So Draper kind of identified on the biggest points of the match, let's make Berrettini hit a great backhand return. And if he does it, too good. You know, oh well, I'm happy losing on that, but let's serve and volley into the backhand and see where we're at. And it ended up being that Draper had good first volleys to look at and executed. Draper, awesome volley performance in this match. Really great. started coming in a lot more in the second half. And, you know, just kind of was almost perfect every time he had a look at a finish when he was inside the service box at the net. So that's all. But first title for Draper, huge, and really good reset after a difficult clay court season, which, again, I feel like everybody should have expected. But I don't know, maybe it still felt really disappointing, you know, when you're losing to Jesper DeJong in the first round at Roland Garros. I don't know, but kind of back on track here. And Berrettini, you know, I'm not going to do too much on him. I think he'll sneak into my top eight favorites coming into Wimbledon. I'm still really high on him. And if you look at what he's been able to do, despite, again, having trouble staying healthy and, you know, being on the court on a regular basis for various reasons, he really has had a really nice success rate 2024 as a whole.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, Herr Togenbosch, Demonor over Korda. Alex continues his terrific year. He is now seventh in the rankings. He is now sixth in the race. Year-end championship watch for Demonor. If it wasn't on before, it is officially on now. I know it's just another 250 title, but you're kind of reminded after Alex has his best ever Roland Garros run, his best ever clay court season. He's good on grass. He's great on hard court. He's in position. Year-end championship is in play, and it's a fantastic goal for Alex. It's something that, as we all know, I think a few years ago, not a lot of people would have thought he would ever... It's not a place that people thought he'd ever get. After kind of the initial surge onto tour where Alex was thought of as a top prospect, but when the trajectory just wasn't really where you'd want it to be, I think those sort of hopes and expectations faded a little bit. But as we know, he's come on strong here. He's added a lot to his game. One of those things is the serve. He has always been a great grass court baseliner. And as a result, he's always been really good on the surface. But you give him a bigger serve, a better serve, and that's kind of an added wrinkle when you look at Demonor as a grass court player. One thing that was really notable at Roland Garros, where he beats Daniil Medvedev, is he actually served quicker than Daniil. And it wasn't even all that close. He averaged 123 miles per hour. Daniil averaged 117 miles per hour. So Alex was 5 miles per hour quicker than Medvedev at Roland Garros. So let's do a little bit of myth busting here. I just want to go through it because we need to kind of adjust our mindsets when we look at Demon Oar as a server. Is he actually at a deficit in serve speed on a regular basis on tour? Let's just go through his run here in Hertogenbosch. He plays Zizou Bergs, averages 124, Zizou 122, so plus two for Demon. He plays Milos Raonic. That's a guy he can't outserve. He averages 124. Milos is at 133, so he's 9 miles per hour less. Plays Hugo Humbert, and he's at 119. Humbert is also at 119. That was kind of a down serve speed match for Demon. Korda in the final, he averages 123. Korda is at 121. That's plus 2 miles per hour for Demon. So is he getting outserved speed-wise on a regular basis? No, not at all. Only Raonic was able to do it on his run in Den Bosch. There were matches last year, and there were big matches last year, where I felt like Demon could have basically started the point with a drop feed. And that's how much his serve was getting neutralized. And against elite players, sometimes I felt like, well, he's actually playing really well from the back and he's doing all he can, but it's a really tough ask to win a match when your serve is just getting handled on a regular basis, point in and point out. And that's just not going to happen as much when you're hitting average first serve speeds 120 to 124 miles per hour. Now, notably, he was the worst location server in the top 20 when Tennis Insights did their servers graphic. I think that was February of this year. So he's still not someone who is always going to be pinpoint with it. But the speed's a big help. It's not just the serve when you think about grass court weapons that Demon Oar has kind of bolstered this year. It's also the backhand slice. Alex is hitting way more backhand slice this year than he ever has in his career. This is his first grass court season that we're really getting a good look at what that shot can do. And as we know with the backhand slice, grass not only makes it more necessary, because when the ball gets low on the two-hander, especially when you don't quite get your feet up to it, it's a lot easier to slice the ball than to hit the drive, the topspin. So not only does that make it more necessary, it's also more effective. So it's your double whammy there, more effective because the ball maintains more speed and it stays lower. It's another way that Demon Oar can attack certain matchups. And that's something that I've been so complimentary of Alex throughout the year, where I just think that he's been able to gauge kind of, who am I playing? What do I need to do in this particular matchup? And now I'm able to execute it. And he's able to do these things mid-matches as well. The slice is just another tool where he can look at who he's playing and he can decide, is this something that I want to lean heavy on? Is this something I want to be kind of sparing on? And at least he now has that option. For Korda, he did not let Seb get into that backhand-to-backhand rhythm at all. You cannot let Korda do that to you, because Seb is going to, like, if you kind of hit him, if you let him find his strike zone on the backhand and you don't disrupt his timing, he's going to kind of kill you with the backhand cross court, backhand down the line redirect combination that he's just so good at. And Alex did a good job breaking that up. A lot of that was the backhand slice. And there's a lot of good slice approaching from Demon Oar in this match, surprisingly. I mean, that's not something that I think is a great play in modern tennis anymore on a regular basis. But on grass, it kind of comes into the fold. Okay, you can approach on a slice backhand, no problem. I think on other surfaces, just with the modern game, polyester strings, crazy racket speed, you got to be careful with slice approaching. On grass, you can do it. Demon Oar did it. The other thing that stood out to me in the final against Korda, man, the depth control is incredible. He forced tons of errors with his depth alone. He created so many attacking opportunities with his depth alone. And it kind of had me thinking of a point that Jonathan Stokey made on his YouTube channel recently. Jonathan Stokey is a coach who I really enjoy learning from. And he made an argument that the most important quality when it comes to ground strokes is depth. That literally, singularly, it matters more than all the other stuff. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting thesis. How are you going to back that up? How are you going to prove your point there? And Stokey said, look, let's separate all the things that make ground strokes effective, right? You have pace, you have width, you have height. Am I missing one, or do I have all of them? I think I might have all of them. Those are the big ones. Oh, okay, yeah. Those are the big ones, okay? So if you have a ball that is middle of the court, so it has no width, it is slow, it has no pace, and it is floating, not a lot of backspin, not a lot of topspin, it's a floater, pretty flat, no heavy spin to deal with, so the height is comfortable, but it lands on the baseline. So it's deep. You removed every good quality in a shot. You only gave it depth. Still, most players can't attack it. And it's hard to say that that's true about any of the other qualities where alone it makes the ball unattackable. You know? So that's a really good argument for depth as the most important ground stroke quality. And as I was watching Demonor play Korda, I was just amazed at his rally balls and how deep they were staying. Now, on the Korda side of things, the worst weakness that was proliferating in this match was the Korda forehand. And it cannot be so mistake-prone. I thought it was better in the second set, but in the first set, I thought it was absolutely unovercomable for Sebastian. In the first set, I scored 8 forehand unforced errors, and this was a 6-2 set. So there were only 8 games. But guess what? This is grass court tennis. So let me break this down for you. 8 forehand unforced errors. I know that might sound like a huge number, but it is. 44 total points played in the set. 13 of them were either double fault, ace, service winner. So essentially, there were no ground strokes in the point. So that makes it so that we're down to 26% of the points that featured returns in play. 26% of them ended in Korda forehand errors from neutral or attack. So I basically, any ball that's in neutral or attack, I score an unforced error. 26% of return in play points ended in Korda forehand errors from neutral or attack. And it's not like he was finding tons of finishes on it either. In fact, he got a little bit tame on a few approach shots that resulted in Demonor passing shots. So, I mean, there were even some potency issues on the Korda forehand because he lost some confidence on it. Not to mention, for the match, Demonor was hitting almost every first serve to Korda's forehand. Alex hit 14 first serve to Seb's forehand. He hit just 3 to the backhand. The rest were body. Again, Demonor, even though he's not a big analytics guy, he's got a high tennis IQ, and he's very tactically aware. So he was like, Korda, backhand return? No, thank you. That's not happening. I'm going to make him hit forehand returns. And if it's a backhand return, it's going to be off of a body serve where he's literally getting out of the way and he has kind of no ability to extend his arms and put his weight into the shot. And there were a lot of forehand missed returns from Korda as well. It's an interesting shot, the Korda forehand, because technically it's a good looking forehand. And sometimes it looks really good, even from a results standpoint. But sometimes, I mean, obviously that makes it hard to diagnose. Like, what's wrong with Korda's forehand? why does he miss it so much? Why is it so leaky? Sometimes I think his feet stop early. So he'll kind of plant his feet, you know, kind of stop and set up for his forehand. And then you see from his contact point, his positioning is off a little bit. It's like, well, you could have continued to popcorn your feet a little bit longer, or, you know, you could have maybe taken an extra shuffle before kind of setting up for the forehand. So sometimes off of the easier balls that are coming in slow, I think his feet stop a little bit early. That's one thing that maybe he can look at. There's not a lot of margin on the shot, period. I mean, yes, he goes for a lot, but it's flat. There's not a lot of net clearance. And that results, sometimes I think that there are target errors, kind of like Felix's forehand. Like for FAA, we look at a lot of forehand unforced errors where it's like, huh, everything looked good. You hit the ball clean. You timed the ball well, but you still missed. Kind of seemed like it was a target error. You picked too precise a location. And then maybe his wrist is a problem. Maybe his wrist just isn't doing exactly what he wants it to do from a strength standpoint, from a flexibility standpoint. Just physically, maybe there are limitations there because he had a wrist issue last year that lingered for a while. And that's always a question mark. Wind was also an issue in this final. It is difficult to play really good tennis in the kind of winds that they were dealing with. Although Korda was in the final and it was windy all week. So he had to have kind of figured it out throughout the week. But ultimately, I thought the wind also helped Demonor. More drop shots and lobs against the wind. Alex did a great job of that. Korda got really frustrated with how often he was getting lobbed whenever he came forward. And that was, first of all, Demonor has a really good lob, but it was also, if you look at it, the wind was blowing from the near side of the court to the far side of the court. All these lobs were hit against the wind. So you're going to hit good lobs when you're hitting it into a wall of wind. But that's smart stuff by Demonor, who also was using the drop shot. Now, Korda figured it out. I think at a certain point in the match, Korda started hitting a lot of drop shots against the wind, but it took him a little while, and Demonor had already built the lead at that point. Alex is more comfortable playing with margin through the middle. Korda takes big aggressive cuts where his positioning and his timing need to be perfect or he misses the ball. I think Demonor has less sensitivity to all that, and he's able to just put the ball in the court even when things aren't perfect, where I think Korda struggles with that sometimes. So I think the wind is worth a mention, but Demonor ultimately straight set win. Obviously a good week for Korda. I don't have tons to say about it, however, and I want to just end on Queens and Halle. I love this week. I think it's one of the best weeks on tour, as I mentioned at the top. No buys, great action right away, stacked draws, condensed draws. Sinner and Alcaraz, they're in different cities. Carlitos is defending his title in Queens. Yannick is playing Halle. Medvedev-Sinner semifinal is in play in Halle. Alcaraz-Dimitrov semifinal is in play in Queens. But ultimately, there are, as I said, stacked draws. Halle's a little bit tougher, a little bit heavier than Queens. But pretty much everyone is playing. In fact, only one top 40 player on the ATP Tour is not playing this week without a known injury. Casper Ruud. He's the only one. It's already been an interesting Monday. Two retirements, I should say, for guys who could really use a big grass season. So this was unfortunate to see, where you have Tiafoe and FAA on this Monday, both retiring. FAA, it looked like a hip issue. Tiafoe had a slip, and it looked like a knee thing for him. Hopefully nothing serious for them. But boy, I mean, it's two guys who don't love the clay and really could use and have had the potential to have a big grass court season. Early loss for Holger Rune against Jordan Thompson. Thompson, man, tough. I mean, I think he's one of those players who, unseeded, you really don't want to see first round of a grass court tournament. Like, you really don't want to see. but obviously it's another early loss for Runa, not ideal. Dimitrov lit up Adrian Mannarino, like lit him up. That was an incredible display. And I'm really intrigued to see what Grigor, former Wimbledon semifinalist, can do on the grass with just how high quality his serve and his forehand has been throughout 2024 so far. And how about Milos Raonic? He has lost nothing on his serve. He breaks a new record, sets a new record for aces in a best of three set match, hits 47 of them in a win over Cam Nori in Queens. Whoa. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.